Good afternoon. This is the Tanfield Chamber's inaugural webinar, Ain't No Party Like a Party Wall Party, in which I, Nicholas Isaac, QC, and Stuart Frame, also of Tanfield Chambers, are going to talk to you, although we can't see you, about three or four different aspects of party wall law. I'm going to talk first a little bit about compensation under Section 7.2. Stuart's going to talk a bit about security for expenses under Section 12.1. And because it's part of what we said we were going to talk about, we're going to talk a little bit about the involvement of party wall surveyors in party wall appeals. And then finally, we've got a few things to say about Section 10, appointment of third surveyors or selection of third surveyors and so on in relation to that. This is, as you'll see, we're not wearing ties. This is fairly informal. And no doubt Stuart will interrupt me and I will interrupt Stuart where we think we've said something that is wrong or maybe wrong.
Maybe we'll just interrupt anyway.
Yeah. And we'll cover a number of relatively recent cases, including Schlechstein and Wainbridge Estates, I think Gray and Elite Town Management, Welter and McKeeve, possibly Reeves and Young and Mills and Savage, as far as Stuart's concerned, and possibly Fenton and Lewis, another recent case that Stuart was involved in. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about Section 7.2 and compensation under Section 7.2. And this arises at the moment because, for me, it's a very common error on the part of surveyors to think that compensation under 7.2, which you will all recall is compensation in respect of any loss or damage suffered by the adjoining owner or adjoining occupier in respect of works in pursuance of the Act. It's a very common mistake by party wall surveyors to think that compensation is only payable in respect of physical damage. And in fact, that's just one aspect of loss and damage, which is recoverable by way of compensation under Section 7.2. So Schlechstein and Wainbridge provides a very recent example of a case in which compensation was awarded by the court on appeal in a wider set of circumstances or in respect of a wider set of heads of loss than one might normally see. In addition to physical damage and the cost of repair, which is the starting point, you as party wall surveyors, and if you're a solicitor when you're looking at what loss or damage is compensatable under Section 7.2, you also need to look at other losses. And these are, I would say, precisely equivalent to loss and damage which is suffered or which can be suffered at common law and is compensatable under tort or under contract. So in a party wall context, most commonly what you are looking at is, in addition to the cost of repair, the consequences of having to carry out that repair. So, for example, if there's significant damage to the adjoining owner's property, that might well include the costs of accommodating the adjoining owner in alternative accommodation during the course of the works.
And that was a big point that was brought up in the case.
That was actually the big point argued in Schlechstein, which I didn't win on, because we didn't get alternative accommodation.
May I ask you something about £700,000. It was
a lot of money. I think the big amount. My client, Mr. Schlechstein's property in that case, I think the evidence was that the open market letting value of it was about £25,000 a week. Mm-hmm. Obviously, fairly substantial, and
you can only get it for 6 months.
Yeah, if you're looking at short term accommodation of that size in London, you're looking at basically paying a premium and a minimum rental period of 6 months. So we were talking well over £500,000 worth of potential alternative accommodation. But in that case, we didn't get it. And indeed, the judge made some...
Obiter comments about
The fact that actually it wasn't necessarily appropriate for alternative accommodation to be of precisely the same size or precisely the same standard. And although this was a five-bedroom house with lots of amenity space and all the rest of it, I think he suggested that a two- or three-bedroom apartment would have been adequate alternative accommodation because it was largely my client, his wife, and their dog.
It was a reasonableness test. It was incorporating again into...
The judge was obiter incorporating a reasonable test into that. So we had alternative accommodation is potentially a very big part of recoverable compensation under Section 7.2.
What about, may I ask, when the remedial works are being conducted, what about inconvenience or loss of amenity payment to the owners?
You may ask that, Stuart, and that's a very good question. Loss of amenity is a very important aspect of losses suffered by owners, and I'd actually split it, and it was split, right, certainly the argument in Schlachstein split it into two different periods, namely loss of amenity suffered from the date of the damage was caused down to the date the repairs commenced.
I.e., so if you have a room that's full of cracks in the period, you have to spend looking at those cracks.
Correct. There's a loss of amenity there. And then, in addition, when the repairs are actually being carried out, there's actually a far more significant loss of amenity.
When you have eight builders trudging through your house.
And if you're put in alternative accommodation, then there's probably less or no loss of amenity because you're not being impacted by the builders in such the same way.
A slight difficulty I had in understanding the Schlachstein case, actually, because there was a payment for loss of amenity, but then it was, weren't the remedial works predicated on the fact that it would be conducted whilst they were out of the country, and that's why the judge said, I'm not going to give you alternative accommodation costs.
The judge was a little bit mean in Schlachstein in terms of the amount he gave us. I mean, given, you know, that the letting value of this property was £25,000 a week, he was fairly swinging in terms of what he allowed by way of loss of amenity. I think it was £2,000 or £3,000. Mm. And he awarded also £2,000 or £3,000 in respect of specific incidents during the build. So there was
a cracked window or something.
Somebody dropped something from a skip as it was being craned over his glass atrium roof, which smashed a pane of glass there. And the other incident was a vibrating roller being used right outside his kitchen, which was pretty unpleasant.
The court's approach in assessing those kind of costs is pretty rough and ready, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think when it comes to surveyors dealing with it, they don't need to be overly concerned with the fact that they're not valuers, for example. I mean, what the classic measure of or the classic way of assessing damages or compensation for loss of amenity is to assess it by reference to a percentage of the open market letting value, rental value of the property. And so, you know, let's say you have a flat which is rented or would be capable of being rented for £1,000 a month. Damage is caused, which means that if you were renting out that flat, you would only get £750 a month. Mm. Then that difference gives you the measure of your loss of amenity. That's quite a scientific approach, and in appropriate cases, it might be appropriate to get valuation evidence in from a third party. Mm. But judges will often deal with this, and so surveyors can deal with this on quite a broad brush.
The difference in rental value over a certain period of time, but of course you can't just sit on the damage and do nothing about it and have an extended period of time. I mean, surely there's a duty to mitigate loss, is there not?
Well, yeah, and we can talk about duty to mitigate, but I mean, duty to mitigate was the big question in Welter and McKeeve, which is another very recent case. I can't talk about it too much because Mr. McKeith has applied for permission to appeal to the Court of Appeal, but the decision at first instance in that case, and that is a case where two neighbours were doing basement extensions. The Welters got on with theirs first. They underpinned the party wall. And then the McKeeves were doing their basement extension. When the McKeeves contractors exposed the underpinned party wall, they realised that it had been done very poorly by the Welters contractors, and there were gaps in the underpinning and slightly out of alignment, not okay. big time, but poor quality concrete,
under strength concrete.
And
although then in the end that wasn't an issue, was it? Because I think the concrete it wasn't retaining anymore.
It wasn't such a big issue, but it was
poorly done.
But the interesting question in that case, in terms of compensation, was the applicability of the common law rule of mitigation of loss, and the big question there was whether the McKeeves had mitigated, had taken reasonable steps to mitigate their loss, because the damage which they claimed, which they'd paid the builders, and which the initial award gave them, was about £180,000. And at the end of the case, the judge said that if they had taken some pretty basic steps to check the figures that they were being provided by the builders, they would have ended up with a much lower figure, which he put at 40,000, 50,000, or 60,000. I can't remember the precise
figure. That brings me to, there's an interesting point about the application of the common law, as it were, in assessing compensation under Section 7.2. I know it's something I think that you argued in a previous case, and forgive me, the name of the case escapes me now, but it always interested me because, as far as I'm concerned, the Act, and I'm sure you will agree, is a discrete statutory regime, and compensation under Section 7.2 is, going back to how you opened, it's very broadly expressed, any loss or damage to any owner or any occupier. I think technically, as a matter of law, it may be wrong, at least I would suggest it may be wrong to suggest that common law principles apply per se.
But I think you're not the only person to have said that to me.
Well, okay. But I would imagine that the court has to create some sort of jurisprudence in relation to Section 7.2 and therefore would borrow from common law principles.
Well, I think it does actually go beyond that. I mean, if you look at Section 7.2, and indeed if what I argued in Lee Valley and Derbyshire...
That would be the case.
Which is the case I think you're thinking of, was that the effect of Section 7.2 is to give the surveyors precisely the same jurisdiction as the court has when it is awarding damages for loss suffered in terms of torts or breaches of contract. And the judge, the Williamson QC, sitting in the TCC in that case, said... I was right. He didn't actually give me what I wanted in the case, but he did say I was right about that.
That part of the judgment.
Yeah, he definitely said I was right about that. And he was quite happy with my premise that that Section 7.2 gives the surveyors the ability to compensate adjoining owners, because it's always adjoining owners or occupiers, in precisely the same way as the court would be able to award damages for tort or breach of contract.
Common law.
Which is why, and in Welter and McKeith, the argument was about whether the appropriate measure of loss was diminution in value or cost of repair, which is an argument I'd run previously in Brewer and Eckercorvey successfully at county court level.
Although in that case, I think the adjoining owner had indicated that she would be selling the property without
carrying out the repairs. Yeah. Whereas in the event in Lee Valley and Derbyshire, after the case was finished, it then went back to the third surveyor, who was Alistair Redler, who determined that the appropriate measure of loss in all of the circumstances was the cost of repair.
I think there's an important point there for surveyors. I'm often us when I'm discussing or giving seminars or attending forums for the Faculty of Particle Affairs or the Pyramus and Thisbe Club. We have this case that says that compensation can be assessed either by diminution in value or by the cost of remedial. How do we know when to use it? And it's a very, very difficult question to answer. I mean, my usual answer, I would suggest, is that, it's the typical lawyer's answer. Well, it depends on the facts of the case.
Yeah, it does. I think it is
fact-dependent.
It is fact-dependent, and I think that's one of the things that came out of Lee Valley. The judge said it's very fact-dependent. Yes. But I think as a rule of thumb...
It's the cost of the remedial.
It's the cost of remedial works.
Yes.
You know, that's generally the basic measure of damage. In fact, that's traditionally the basic measure of diminution in value anyway.
Yes, you know, would be based on the cost of remedial works. So I normally, when I'm advising off the cuff, I would normally tell surveyors, well, probably in 90-95% of your cases, it will be the cost of remedial works.
And I'd agree with that.
And not to overly exercise themselves too much about diminution in value.
No, and you have to have an unusual set of circumstances to give rise to a decent argument that it's a diminution in value claim. Albeit, I still think it was a pretty good argument
Course, the two heads of law can't be run simultaneously. I have known surveyors that tried to claim diminution in value and the cost of remedial.
Okay, well, that really is
double recovery.
That's double recovery. Although you could have a situation in which there was a permanent loss potentially caused by notifiable works because it had a permanent impact on the value of the adjoining owner's property, potentially, but let's not go into that now. A couple of very short extra points on compensation under 7.2, just before we move on. First of all, something which is fairly common is the cost of putting belongings into storage and or moving them from the property to alternative accommodation.
And that was covered in the Schlachtstein case.
Was covered. In fact, that was a fairly substantial part of the damages, or the compensation which was awarded in Schlachtstein. So, you know, don't forget that is an aspect of the loss.
And wasn't there an award of compensation in Schlachtstein for the surveyor overseeing the remedial works on the basis that not all the belongings would be put into storage? I think that's how the judge justified it.
I think it's obviously there is a physical cost of having a contractor carry out works. Mm-hmm. In appropriate cases, you will also get the cost of supervision, which is usually a percentage of the works. And there was a percentage. There was a 10% percentage awarded in Schlachtstein. So that's fairly common.
You did touch on Welter and McKeever. We won't discuss it too much, but again, there's another issue that arises there with Section 7.2, and quite a common scenario is the overspilling of concrete where a party wall has been underpinned, either underpinning per se or where it's been underpinned to form a basement wall.
Absolutely. I mean, concrete overspill is now, with the proliferation of basements in West London in particular, it's a really common scenario, and I can't remember the number of cases I've now done which have involved concrete overspill. I don't want to go into it really too much today. I think that probably justifies a separate webinar on concrete overspill because there's quite a lot to it. I'm going to move on from that. In fact, unless there's anything else, I don't know. Have we got any questions about what we've said so far? This is new to me, by the way, everybody, so you have to bear with me. We're going to receive questions afterwards, so I can't give you live answers, unfortunately. Or we can't give you live answers. So, in which case, I think we'll stop for the moment talking about Section 7.2 compensation, and we'll...
Going to touch on security for
expenses.
We'll
move on to talking about security for expenses. And mainly Stuart's going to talk about this. But I'll mention briefly that it was in the most recent Schlachtstein case, security for expenses was one of the issues because there had been security for expenses for this very big, very expensive project had originally been lodged in the sum of £2 million. After the works were complete, the surveyors made an award reducing the security to £100,000. That was before the award in relation to compensation for damage caused was made, and we appealed that award on the basis that £100,000 was in no way enough. But there are, and indeed, again, we succeeded on that argument. It was increased to 350 or 400,000, I can't remember which. But the point I want to take from that case, and the point which I suppose is an important one given the historic way that surveyors have looked at security for expenses, is that the security in that case, even after the reduction, was retained in respect of the loss and damage, or the damage caused to the adjoining owner's property. So it wasn't retained in respect of the traditional completing the notifiable work.
So in fact, it was taken as given in that case that it wasn't security for expenses, it was security for compensation.
Well, that of course, depends on your definition of expenses. And that's where, you know, that's where the argument lies under Section 12.1. You know, what are expenses under the Act, which starts at Section 11 of the Act, rather.
Yes,
than
well, that's where I think that's the first place where expenses are mentioned in the Act, is in Section 11. My take on expenses is that expenses are as mentioned in Section 11. The problem, it seems to me, that has arisen in Section 12 is the marginal note to Section 12, which simply says security for expenses. And no more. And I think arising from that, surveyors, perhaps quite understandably, have said, well, OK, so it's security for expenses. And then perhaps that's where this notion of... I'm not even sure that's where the notion of completing the works has come from. I'm not sure where this... you could have security for completing the works has actually derived from.
Well, I think you were saying earlier that the earlier acts, the other London Building Acts.
Well, that's the interesting point. If you look at the previous acts, the 1939 and the 1894 acts, in the equivalent sections of those acts, they give a similar wording as we see in subsection 1 of section 12, except they, in subsection 1 of the 96 acts, it refers to a dispute being determined in accordance with Section 10, and I think in those predecessor acts it refers to the dispute being determined but by a judge of the county court, but then it goes on to say, and then it gives a definition of what the security is for, and it says for compensation, costs and expenses. Yeah. Now, obviously we can't use predecessor acts too much in interpreting, but in limited circumstances we can, and I think it gives us an inkling as to really where the security regime derived from and what it can be applied
to. Well, I mean, I would say as a general rule now, and Schlachstein is a good example of that, that you can generally assume that security, that you are entitled to ask for security to cover the cost of compensation or the potential compensation.
And costs, i.e. surveyors' costs? I
mean, well, that was an issue in Schlachstein. Ooh. And it wasn't decided in principle because there was the undertaking given in respect of the security explicitly included all liabilities, so it definitely included professional costs. Now, the more interesting question is can and should it include professional costs generally? Well, I don't know about that.
Perhaps with some surveyors' fees there should be security, but perhaps I'm risking upsetting the audience.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I have seen a number of cases where it's certainly struck me at the time that the primary motivator for the request for security was the surveyor wanting to ensure that his fees were secure, the adjoining owner's surveyor's fees were secure, rather than anything else. Mm. And that, I would generally say that is wrong.
I mean, we have limited case law on security for expenses. I think the first case we had really, well, at least under the 96 Act, I'm not aware of any other cases under the predecessor acts actually that deal with it. We, of course, have the well-known case of Kay against Lawrence, which technically is a county court decision, although of, I would suggest, particularly persuasive authority, as we had Mr. Justice Ramsey sitting with his county court judge's hat on. And he determined that security for expenses can apply for Section 6 excavation works.
He did, because the argument was if I as the building owner would be entitled to common law to carry out works, then the Act doesn't apply and Section 12.1 doesn't apply. Well,
there was a legal differentiation that was attempted to be made in that case between rights conferred by the Act and then works in pursuance of this Act.
Anyway, it failed.
Well, it failed, although I think there was... Technically, as a matter of...
It failed. I mean, for me, one of the interesting things about Kane Lawrence, other than it's actually a much narrower decision than most people give it credit for, is that... contrary to the general expectation among the surveying community, the security being demanded in that case and the security which the judge thought was appropriate in that case was an insurance policy.
And that's a very important point, I think. Yeah. Is security doesn't need to be monies in an escrow account. It can be by way of insurance. And I would suggest perhaps that is the way forward and the way that should be adopted, because what we do see is claims for security that are pitched at such a high level and asked for in terms of monies in an account that it actually threatens the actual development
as a matter of principle, it seems to me, and I think you'd agree with this, that if security is demanded and or was awarded in a sum which made it impossible for the building owner to carry out the notifiable works, that would in principle be wrong. An important point for surveyors to take away also, as you've already mentioned, is that security can be provided in another way. So I had a case that never went settled before trial, but I think there was 1.5 million awarded by way of security. And I was appealing that, although my client, as it happened, had provided it, was in a position to provide it. But we were appealing it, and the judge at an interim hearing said, well, I see no reason why security couldn't be provided, for example, by a charge over the building owner's property.
That's an interesting one.
Which is one you don't see generally.
For very often, because the development itself is being funded in stages anyway, and the building owner may not necessarily have those sort of funds available. So, yeah.
No, I mean, very often funds are tight on development. It's not surprising. And if somebody suddenly says you need to cough up 10% or 20% of the value of the development or the cost of the development, which is quite often the sums you're talking about, then that can be very difficult. I think you said you were not aware, but I know there's been some discussion. There was a P&T kind of information evening about security a while ago.
P&T or child and children event? I think it was.
Well, there's probably been both. But at which the this insurance. Specific because somebody I can't remember now.
There is a bespoke
insurance policy, specifically designed for security and designed to satisfy party wall surveyors that it's adequate security.
Mm. Of course, I don't know so much about that, but I have heard of it.
I've seen it. I've seen the policy. Seen it suggested in a couple of cases. I'm not aware. I haven't actually seen a case yet where the policy has been number one taken out or number two called upon. Mm. But I think it's an interesting development
seems to be an interesting way forward. Of course, the security for expenses. There's a right to ask for security for expenses, which is what you said at the beginning of this particular area. But the right to ask for something is not the same as the right to have something, is it?
No, and I think there's a common misconception that if you ask under the terms of Section 12.1, you must have.
Yeah,
but the question is, and in a sense, that's right, because you must have appropriate security. But the question is, what is appropriate security? Appropriate or adequate security? Mm. And in many cases, you know, if you have, for example, if you have a building owner who has lived in that property for 20 years, it's their home, it has no mortgage on it. Mm-hmm. They're doing notifiable works because they, you know, want a bigger house, or they're doing a refurbishment, and they're not going anywhere. It's not owned by an offshore company. There's absolutely, or on the face of it, there's no reason whatsoever why you should need security or why security should be awarded.
So we've got security for what I would call security for compensation for damage,
yeah,
potentially. But what about the traditional view of security for completing works? I mean, that I've never actually seen security used for completing works.
No, I think I can't remember who. One of the better known London surveyors sent an email around, I think, last year, because he was going to do a talk on security, asking whether any of the addressees of this email or the recipients of this email had ever seen security used for that
email,
for
yes,
that purpose. And as far as I recall, there wasn't
a single person.
No, so I mean, although that's the traditional, I agree that's the traditional view of what represents security. In practice, I've just not seen it, not seen it used for that. And again, as we were discussing earlier, there are practical and legal difficulties for an adjoining owner faced with the theoretical situation of a building owner leaving site with the notifiable works uncompleted, because you know how do you say you have a right to go in and do works even if the money's available to do it? And I think I talked about the potential for abating a nuisance as being one potential legal route to do that. And you said, well, wouldn't it be just as easy to go off to court and get an injunction?
Get an emergency injunction for access, I think, would be perhaps... You'd be careful, I think, with abatement, because I think
I'm a fan of self-help remedies, but I'm perhaps a little too bold in that area.
I think that's as much as something I can cover on security, with the limited... case law that we have on
okay,
that
well, let's,
area.
Let's move on then and talk about
surveyors and Section 10.
Yeah, let's start by talking about the involvement of party wall surveyors in appeals, because this really all started with Fars Lane, where we were against each other.
I would just disagree. Okay. There's a very old case, but quite a well known case called Zissis and Lekompsky, and actually in that case, the full name of the case is Zissis against Lekompsky and Carter. And
the
Mr.
surveyor
Carter was the surveyor.
Yeah, but they agreed that he shouldn't have been joined.
Well, he was actually...
He was actually
joined for the purposes of costs at the end of the initial appeal in the county court. But he had involved himself very heavily in the appeal.
No, I had forgotten.
Yeah. So I think technically that probably was the first one. But
it's the first one where it was argued as an issue is certainly fascinating.
Yes, yes. Okay. And I think there may have been reference by me to this is in Fars Lane, I think.
I'm sure there was. You have said to me since that you always thought you were right about your argument in Fars Lane,
yeah.
And I said...
And
I
you always thought you were right.
And indeed,
one of the areas
say,
we've always
put it out there,
on.
I still do, I still think I'm right. I think Mr. Justice Holgate got it wrong, but at the moment it's
but who's he? He's just a High Court judge.
Yeah, so that's the law as it stands at the moment is what Mr. Justice Holgate said in Fars Lane. And what he said, which, you know... as far as party wall surveyors concerned, was great, was that party wall surveyors could directly enforce payment to them of fees in an award.
Yes.
That was, I think, as far as many party wall surveyors concerned, that was great news, because previously the better view, it's only my view, therefore the better view, was that if you as a party wall surveyor wanted to enforce payment of your fees in an award, you would have to get an assignment of the right to do so
because it was only the owners who had the right to enforce an award, and that was a route that the judge described.
So that was so. But to me, the interesting thing about Fars Lane is it's very much a double-edged sword.
Absolutely.
And so the plus side for surveyors is, yay, we can go to the magistrates' court and enforce payment of our fees. The downside is that the judge also said that it was perfectly proper in appropriate cases, which he thought would be exceptional.
Yes.
For party wall surveyors to be joined as parties for the purposes of costs, particularly to appeals.
And I remember, I don't know if you remember that point when he was, I think it was during your argument, and what the judge described in the judgment as the respondent problem or something like that. But I remember it being, and I always remember vividly in that case, the judge leaning forward over, and he said, well, the surveyors had better behave themselves then, hadn't they? And that was the stinging the tail of the case.
Well, and this
you have this right to enforce and put your fees in an award, be you, whether you're the adjoining owner surveyor or now the building owner surveyor, and you've got all these additional rights to put these your fees in the award or costs as they are and enforce them yourself directly. But if your fees are unreasonable, you could find yourself on the wrong end of an appeal and being joined as a party to that appeal. And it was at that point the judge, as I said, very memorably to me anyway, said the surveyors had better behave themselves. Then.
Well, he did make a point about that, and he the reason he thought it was exceptional was he thought that surveyors were always reasonable.
Which, of course, they are.
Which many of them are, but there are always some who are not. And indeed, there are some, it could be said, who... whether they think they're being reasonable or not, the court will disagree. I was going to ask, actually, am I right in saying that you do have a case or have done a case where a surveyor was joined or applied to be joined to an appeal?
There was the case of Reeves against Young and Antino, but that wasn't strictly an appeal of an award, because that was... In that particular case, the...
Was it a preliminary issue or a declaration?
No. The building owner had failed to appeal the award, so it was a Part 8 claim for a declaration that the award was a nullity. The surveyor making the award was named as a party to the award. So that was less a case of an appeal of an award and a surveyor being joined subsequently. He was a party from the outset to that.
Yeah, and I mean, I've had the cases, again, it's not quite the same, but I'm just thinking about surveyors being party to proceedings. I had the case of Mohammed against Antino and Stevens, where Messrs. Antino and Stevens, who were respectively the adjoining owner surveyor and the third surveyor, were wanting to make awards
over and above the
after a settlement had been reached between the parties in a mediation which said all disputes between the parties had been resolved, including specifically any disputes under section 10. And so they were parties to that, but that's because they were threatening to make awards which, as far as we were concerned and the court confirmed, that they didn't have jurisdiction to make.
Well, that was a claim for a declaration and a subsequent
that
injunction.
That was a claim for an injunction and a declaration. But I'm interested because we're two, nearly 3 years on from Farslane, I think, whether anybody's had experiences of surveyors being joined for the purposes of cost.
I haven't had experience of them being joined for the purposes of cost, but certainly they can be, as Farslane suggested. I'm wondering, however, whether they can be named as a party to an appeal if the appeal involves issues over their costs, if there was an appeal over the level of their costs, and that potentially is a legal interest that the surveyor has in the award.
Well, of course, the situation is that when you issue an appeal under the Act, under the court rules, you are required to send a copy of the appeal notice to the tribunal.
So to the surveyor. I think that's more about them because isn't there a follow-on section from that? That's 52D, isn't it? Practice direction. I think that's in. And isn't there a follow-on section that the tribunal, it allows the tribunal to below, in this case, the party of all surveyors, to make representations to the court about the appeal.
Effectively, if you have an appeal which, let's say, the award is an award for surveyors' costs, and the adjoining, and it's for the adjoining owner surveyors' costs, obviously, and the adjoining owner says, well, this has nothing to do with me, I want nothing to do with this, I think what Farslane does is it gives the
adjoining owner's surveyor the opportunity to more or less step into the shoes of the adjoining owner for the purposes of the appeal, because the adjoining owner is going to say, you know, in fact, I've had cases where the adjoining owner is going, well, look, hands up, I'm not defending this. I'm entirely neutral. The court can make whatever decision it wants, but I don't want to be visited with the costs of this appeal, because why should I? I've done nothing wrong.
Normally, I think I have had one of those previously, and we've invited the adjoining owner to play no part in the appeal.
On the basis that we
wouldn't pursue costs against them.
I've just remembered actually that I have had a case, and the reason I didn't remember it before is because there's been no order yet. But I had a case where I was acting for the building owner, an award was made rather out of the blue by an agreed surveyor. Saying, right, damages or compensation under 7.2 for damage caused to the adjoining owner's property, £40,000, including professional fees. We appealed that. The adjoining owner said, eventually, nothing to do with me. Mm. I didn't ask them to do this. You know, all of the procedural shortcomings which you're complaining about were nothing to do with me anyway. I want nothing to do with it. We had, in the meantime, applied to join the surveyor. We had applied to join him for the purposes of costs. And what then happened is the adjoining owner caved in terms of the... They said, right, fine, you allow the appeal. We'll pay your costs of the appeal, but we want to take over your application to join the surveyor to pursue him for costs. And I think that may still be ongoing.
Yes. I think that deals with surveyors in appeals, as far as we can take it. But I'd like to talk about Section 10 generally, and it's a big...
I know you've got some trumpet blowing to do about Section 10. Have I? And apparently, that's what you told me earlier, I'm sure.
Oh, really?
What I've
learnt, actually, in recent years from the cases that I've done is... First and foremost, and indeed from the Forest Lane case, because I stuck rigidly to the wording of the Act, and what I'm realising more and more is that it's the exact precise wording of the Act that tends to trump everything and overrides everything. That's where the court will always begin and always look, and it seems an obvious point, but it's perhaps a point that not everyone always picks up on. I'd like to look firstly at third surveyor selections. Leaving aside the agreed surveyors award when I've seen third surveyors selected, but that's thankfully happening less and less these days, it does seem to me there are still a couple of problems arising from third surveyor selections. I pick up very much on the word forthwith in section 10.1b. So it's the very, as far as I'm concerned, it's the very, very first duty of surveyors before they do anything, before they even engage in dealing with the issues, to select a third surveyor. And I think that's important. I think that the statutory tribunal, as it's been referred to in some cases, must be properly constituted before any further action can be taken.
So that's the argument that the selection of a third surveyor is a precondition to a valid award being made.
I think so. Because if you don't, and I think I'd hang the argument mainly on the rights in section 10.11, because if you look at... And incidentally, I think I'm right in saying that, referring to predecessor acts again, that the right to refer to a third surveyor in predecessor acts was limited to the surveyors, and only in circumstances where the surveyors were in disagreement with each other. Now, Section 10.11 is far, far broader than...
Well, I'd say it took me a surprisingly long time to pick up the fact that Section 10.11 allows the...
Parties.
The parties, the appointing owners... to refer matters to the third surveyor, and that's something I'm actually constantly telling people. Well, look, if the surveyors aren't getting on with it, you can make a reference to the third surveyor.
And I think so. That is an absolute right that the Act gives to the parties. Now, if a third surveyor hasn't been selected from the outset, and the surveyors just merrily go along their way and start taking scheduled condition and resolving the dispute and preparing draft awards without selecting a third surveyor, then I would suggest that they have. They've affected that absolute right that the parties have to refer the matter to the third surveyor at any stage, because they haven't set the tribunal up, and therefore Section 10.11 cannot be affected.
Well, but in a sense, I mean, it's interesting that you're putting it in that way, but you're saying, you know, they haven't selected a third survivor, but they've gone on and done a schedule of condition and they've exchanged draft awards. Yeah.
They got on with their duties.
The key duty, their sole duty, in really under Section 10, is to make an award, is to resolve the dispute by making an award. So provided that they've selected the third surveyor before then, you certainly can't. You couldn't say that an award was invalid because the third surveyor had not been selected. Had not been selected at some earlier point. Provided they've been selected by the date the award is made, that's sufficient.
That would be your argument, wouldn't it?
Okay. Well, I'm putting that.
I would disagree because of the absolute right.
Let's give you a set of circumstances here, similar to what you've said. So you have a situation where there's a deemed dispute. The parties appoint their own surveyors. No third surveyor is selected. The parties' surveyors exchange communications, they prepare a schedule of condition, they exchange a draft award, and then they're fairly well down the process, in fact. And then one of them goes, hang on a minute, we haven't selected a third surveyor, we'd better do that. And they go, oh, the other says, absolutely fine. Unusually, they immediately agree on a third surveyor.
Yeah. Unusually,
it's not Alistair Redler, let's put it that way.
Well.
They then, after doing that, they make an award. Now, and the award will recite that the third surveyor has been selected, which he has.
That's a selection in the recital.
No, the selection's made before the award is made. Are you suggesting that there's some issue?
I think it could be argued, absolutely, but
not successfully.
Well, I think. We'll have to see. There are a few live cases I haven't.
Okay, so that's okay. Yeah. That's why you're expressing particular interest in it.
Yes. I think it's important that the surveyors, over and above the mandatory terms in Section 10.1b, because it says they shall forthwith select a third surveyor, but once they've done that, it's important, for the same reasons I've given in Section 10.11, that they tell the parties who the third surveyor is.
Absolutely, and that, I have to say, that's a fairly common failing. Mm. You know, and it's a very
common failing.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
And I think that's you know, one thing that surveyors need to be very, very careful of, because if the parties subsequently find out that they had this option to go down the third surveyor route and it's been denied to them and nobody's told them who the third surveyor is, that could lead to problems with the surveyors themselves down the line. In other arenas.
Another point we talked about before we went online, or whatever it is we're doing now, before we went live, was what happens in terms of third surveyors. And I've got to put myself off my...
The selection once made is immutable, if that's the right word, I think.
We've got property supply against verity, which we were against each other.
Yeah, which was an interesting case where the building owner surveyor and the adjoining owner surveyor had both deemed themselves incapable of acting at various stages, and the new surveyors felt that they were entitled to, amongst other things, but one of the issues in the case, they were entitled to select a new third surveyor. And it transpired, or at least according to Judge Bailey, that the original selection made by the original party appointed surveyors, it stood. And again, this is another example of a case where if you read the Acts carefully and take a literal interpretation of a plain and obvious meaning of the words, I think with hindsight that must be the right decision.
Yeah.
Although I know the judge in that case did subsequently express surprise that it was never appealed. But perhaps he thought there was a point to be argued there. But there we are. And again, subsequently in the Reeves and Young and Antino case, we had the selection of the third surveyor in writing, and subsequently that was then just changed by the two party-appointed surveyors who happened to be from the same firm.
They were trying to change it for convenience because one third surveyor had been.
There was two adjoining owners. And we had one third surveyor on one side and another third surveyor on the other side, and they were just trying to regularise the third surveyor selection for both adjoining owners, so they just changed it at the last minute. But of course, unfortunately, in that case, the initially selected third surveyor, his identity had quite correctly been informed the past had been informed as to his identity in writing. And that was a case where the subsequent third surveyor then made an award, and that award was then declared.
I just remember the point I was going to talk about before, which was that some surveyors, and we talked about this before, some surveyors are very good and very properly warn their appointing owners before they refer anything to the third surveyor.
This is an important point.
In making a reference to the third surveyor, they are opening themselves up to a costs risk, because the normal way that a third surveyor's award is made under Section 1011 is that it awards costs against the losing party in exactly the same way as the losing party would pay costs in court.
And although I'm not sure, sorry to digress from that, but I'm not sure that that is the appropriate way of awarding costs in all circumstances. But it
doesn't necessarily follow in all court cases either. I would agree with you, it's not necessarily appropriate in all cases, but it's the general rule, and it's correct. But as a matter of practice, I would absolutely recommend, to surveyors that they...
It's an imperative.
Yeah, that they warn their appointing owners that if they make this reference to the third surveyor, it will have cost implications. Because in many cases, you know, and this is another point you made earlier about the role of the surveyors is not to have an intellectual set to about what the correct interpretation of the Act is. They are there to resolve disputes in a sensible, reasonable fashion. And there is a tendency for some surveyors to say, well, you don't agree with me, so we're going off to the third surveyor, not even informing their appointing owners that they're doing so, and not informing their appointing owners that these have cost consequences. And in many cases, in very many cases, appointing owners, when they realise what the situation is, they'll say, well, why are we arguing about this? We'll just agree that this is the situation.
Mm.
That's
an important point. I mean, coming on to it's a phrase that I tend to use quite regularly, but the intellectual jousting point that tends to go on between surveyors in correspondence. This is my interpretation. No, so you can't do that. Yes, I can. No, I can't. And it was all well and good, but of course, I would always encourage surveyors to stop and think, well, who is paying for their time?
Yeah.
To engage in this kind of intellectual jousting. And very often, I'll give an example. I think there was a case called Sy against Compal. I believe that's the correct case. But in that case, there was an issue. But there was the issue, wasn't there, as to whether a notice for underpinning needed to be subsequently served.
Yeah.
And the surveyors, they argued about it. The way I can see it, there was legitimate arguments on both sides. So there is an argument that once the surveyors are seized of the dispute, that there is no need for further notices to be served, because the surveyors can incorporate subsequent disputes into their jurisdiction. But the court went against that, and again, sticking to a rigid reading of the Act, because service of notices is mandatory, the court said... So one surveyor said... Let me lay the facts, I'd better... very shortly, there was a notice served for Section 2 works to a party wall, as I understand matters. Surveyors were appointed, and then subsequently it became apparent that some underpinning would also be required. The initial notices didn't have the underpinning.
It was a bit more fundamental than that. The original design was for an inboard pile design, and then actually after Chatterer, Chinder and Fairholme, the building owner said, well, hang on, why am I doing that design when I can get more room in my basement if I do the Chatterer, Chinder design?
Yep.
So he went from an inboard piled foundation to an underpin, a reinforced underpin. And that was the change. And that was obviously so fundamental as far as the judge was concerned. It wasn't even a variation, it was a completely different
scheme.
Right. Really.
But the point... I mean, one surveyor argued, well, look, there is a dispute between these parties fundamentally about basement works, albeit that the way the basement wall is going to be created is now different. And he said, so we can just deal with this as a variation, in effect. And the other surveyor says, no, you must serve a new notice. And the surveyors, I mean, as I say, you were involved in the case, perhaps you know more about the background, but to my reading of the judgment, the surveyors became, they locked horns over whether a notice should be served. And what I would say to surveyors is, look, even if you think you're right, in that case, it would have been very easy just to serve a notice.
Yeah, I think probably the reason why a notice was not served in that case by the surveyor was because that would have kicked off a further notice period.
But that notice period can always be waived.
It could be waived, and indeed there was an expression that they would be willing to waive it. So, I mean, it, in a sense, was an argument that didn't need to be...
And in fact, I think it's section 10.12 that says that that period could be waived. I think that little paragraph at the end...
It can certainly be changed by agreement.
Yeah, absolutely. So it seems to me that just because you're right, you shouldn't lose sight of the fact, or even if you think you're right on a particular point, sometimes the better way... is to say, well, okay, look, I think I'm right on this point. I disagree with you. However, for the sake of progressing this and for resolving the dispute, I will serve a notice. And
if you think about the number of awards that are made in the UK in any given year, the vast majority of surveyors must take that approach because the vast majority of awards never cross our desks.
And I suppose it's very easy for us as lawyers who are at the sharp end to be critical of the way surveyors... perform their statutory functions, but we always see the we're at the sharp end.
We see where it's gone wrong.
So perhaps our view is slightly skewed as to how
quite
possibly perform.
I think one because we're running out of time, but one of the final things that we talked about before in this respect was surveyors' fees, the reasonableness thereof, and proportionality, because. It's a fairly common feature of cases which certainly come to me and I suspect come to you as well, that somebody, usually the building owner, is very unhappy about the level of fees which have been charged by one or other surveyors or both of the surveyors. It's something I try and remind surveyors about on a fairly regular basis, that their fee is not simply their hourly rate time multiplied by the amount of hours they say they've spent on this particular party wall matter. I think in Patel and Peters, as you were talking about earlier, Patel and Peters is a good example of a situation where the court said it was perfectly appropriate for one of the surveyors to take his stand on the basis that a reasonable fee for this kind of award would be X. I think it was a couple of £1,000, as opposed to the £20,000, which, based on somebody else's timesheets...
in effect, summarily assessing what the reasonable level of fees should be, rather than going through an entire log of timesheets.
Yeah. But I think the other, you know, a key point which is often missed is that reasonableness, and this is something that carries over really from legal costs, is that reasonableness is quite often dependent upon the proportionality of the fee to the dispute. So when you're talking about a relatively minor domestic extension with very limited notifiable works, and the cost of the notifiable works is, you know,
£1,000
worth, you know, it is absolutely unsustainable and indeed disproportionate and unreasonable to have surveyor's fees of let's say £1,500 to £2,000 per owner, which is a situation I have seen.
Absolutely, I've seen it very, very regularly.
And in those circumstances, you know, the surveyors need to be looking at cutting this off at a very low level. I'm not going to give a figure, but a much, much lower
level
than that.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to touch very, very quickly. I know we're running out of time. I don't know if we're allowed to... Oh, OK. Well,
got 2 minutes.
OK. Ex parte awards. So, Patel and Peters is a case that's mentioned. I was recently involved in a county court appeal of an award in Birmingham, a case called Cook against Ashmore. The one thing I want to say about ex parte awards is treat them with... whenever you act ex parte, you have to do so with extreme care. The one thing that I see time and time again that surveyors seem to get wrong is that they decide to act ex parte just because the other side disagrees with them. And that, in effect, is not the test under Section 10.6 or 10.7. It's whether the other surveyor is refusing to act effectively or is neglecting to act effectively. Refusing or neglecting to act effectively is not the same as disagreeing or taking a different position with your other number. So very, very, very careful about that. One other thing, we were going to quickly mention Fenton and Lewis point.
Ooh, which we barely got time to do. But this is
shall
the
we
case.
Leave it for another day then?
Let's leave it for another day.
Okay, well, yeah, that's another webinar.
For another day. Just in closing, because we're coming up to the end, we've mentioned quite a lot of cases this afternoon. By the magic of our marketing manager, when this webinar goes up on the website in due course, the names of those cases and the references for them will be added. You can find most of those cases as well, certainly the county court cases, on my website, not Chambers' website, on my website, which is boundariesbook.co.uk, and that again, that URL will go up on the video in due course. Yeah, you can subscribe to my website. I'm not sure that Stuart actually has subscribed to my website. I'm not sure why not. If you subscribe to the website, then when I put something else on, when I put a new case or an article or a webinar up there, then you'll be notified by email of it. Thanks very much, everybody, for coming to watch. I have no idea how many of you have actually stayed for the hour, but somebody will probably tell me at some point. Thank you for coming to this webinar. There will be, I think, we're doing a webinar a month. Not necessarily Stuart and I, but Tamfield are doing a webinar a month. Hopefully we'll be doing some more specific party war ones as well. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.